This one doesn't relate, well, in a way it does, but it doesn't relate quite as directly to things we would call, you know, church-related or religious-related, but I think in terms of reinventing the faith, I think there are some issues here and some very startling and, I think, surprising statistics, which we will talk about that mean that maybe there's something here about us. But, of course, on the other hand, just the fact that we're all at home means that we're interested in community and associating with others and getting along. Okay, so it can go different ways, but I think some of the material here is surprising. I take this from a very interesting article. It was written by a professor at Harvard last year, Robert Putnam. And the title of it was, and then I'll explain it later where it fits in, and that's why we use this term, solo bowling. We're not going to go over to the bowling alley here. They don't have an automatic pin setter anyway. So anyway, but solo bowling and the subtitle I used here has individualism replaced community in our country. And I think what's happening is that in Americans, what we call voluntary associations, or sometimes called their associational lives or part of their lives, clearly what's happening is that, and I think this is true in the churches too, we're becoming more self-centered, we're becoming more individualistic, we are certainly becoming less trusting. I've got some startling statistics on that. And we're drawing away from an earlier time, I think, and we're drawing away from an earlier time in which people participated much more freely and openly and directly, I think, in other kinds of community activities. I always give one example, and we can talk about it here, and we can talk about it later. Whatever, stop to think about this from some of you, especially who are older, whatever happened to the Sunday night prayer meeting at the church? Stop to think of it. When you grew up, it was worship service, probably 10:30 or 11 on Sunday, and there was the prayer meeting 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock on Sunday night. Woe unto you if you missed, either of them. And the clearly something happened here. That's going on. I'm sure most of you go to older ones go to the Sunday night prayer meeting. It is more devotional, more with hymns and things like this, and you wouldn't get it going now. Okay, anyway, I didn't get anywhere with that one, so I'll go on to the next one. All right, but what Professor Putnam's calls the vibrancy, I think this is true, the vibrancy of American life certainly has declined a good deal. There's much less trust, there's much more cynicism. It says something about our cartoons, for instance, that kids and not only kids watch, when the biggest stars in cartoons now are Beavis and Butthead. And this is about as cynical and pessimistic, and the only word for it is nihilistic, I think, the word that you can find, or Bart Simpson, or other people like that. Now, what I want to use a big term here that I learned from Professor Putnam. He argues that what we're experiencing is what he calls a decline in social capital. The terms of the word that I have on the board here. The decline in social capital. Now, he's taking a word from economics and from banking and applying it to social relations. By social capital, he means all those good experiences, all the networks, all the goodwill, all the community experiences and everything that we've grown up with and we know to be important and worthwhile and significant in our life. And we use these experiences and background and insight and understanding and draw from them the way, say, a businessman might draw capital from a particular fund there. And that is sort of the fund of goodwill. Does that make any sense? What I'm trying to say? Norms, experiences, associations, all those things like this that have happened. I'm using his expressions here. Networks, norms, communities, goodwill, social trust that facilitate, cooperation in our society for our mutual benefit. He calls this term, to give it sort of an academic label, he calls this social capital. Okay, I want to be sure it was a new term for me, and, so anyway, what was it? Winnie the Pooh said, I'm just a little bear with a very little brain and big words bother me, or something else like that. But anyway, social capital, okay. Now, and he argues that the loss in social capital is a real loss, a genuine loss of things that are taking place in American life. And he's got some remarkable statistics here. He said, this is a real loss for several reasons, because, when we did have more social capital, when we had a life that was much more, as he calls it, vibrant, this life was more rewarding in a community which was blessed with a substantial amount of social capital. We responded more freely. We encouraged more social trust. We solved our mutual problems more easily when we had more social capital, on which to draw. we had more experience in this. We were doing this just to give you one statistic. The number of people in PTA, just as one example, has gone down from 12 million people to 7 million people. Just one example of what I'm getting at here to suggest of what's happened. Because in older times, something like PTA was a marvelous opportunity for people to get together, to associate, to work out situations. You did it on a local level, that was important. You know, you weren't doing something that came to you from the state capital or from Washington or anywhere else like this, but it was yours, it was as good as you wanted it to be. And he's arguing that that had created a sort of a sense of trust and mutual goodwill among people, which he found to be, you know, very vibrant and exciting in American life. And what's happened, just one other thing, and what happened then was that once we had learned how to live and get along with one another and take care of our problems on a mutually cooperative kind of basis, we had a confidence to face the future, that we could solve our problems in the future. It was a time really of looking forward to the future with much more anticipation and goodwill than we have today. Now, but he said this, and I think he's absolutely right on this, today we live far more in a world of pessimism, far more in a world of cynicism, far more in a world of diminishing expectations of what can be and what can't be accomplished in so many areas in our life. And he argues that our lives are the poorer for this because of the cynicism, because of I'll cite some of the polls here, and the suspicion and the lack of confidence really in the future, the lack of in the confidence that we can really solve some of these problems. He said, we would be better people, we would have a better society if we could get out of ourselves, if we would find the rewards and the pleasures in getting along with other people, to learn and to trust with other people, rather than follow this course in what then I'll explain solo bowling that's going on now. He argues, and I think he's right on this, we really aren't the people we used to be, in the late 1990s. It's a very pessimistic outlook, but there are some things here that I think should be said. Okay, now, that was his opening thing, decline in social capital. And he this caught on, and it was enormously widely discussed in the newspapers and on television and magazines and in places like this. And it seemed when it happened, I sort of have a Holden vial. I have my HV vial, when I knew it was coming, and I start clipping and putting things in there. And this one was right at the top of the heap there for things that were there because we have such good discussions at. Well, okay, what kind of evidence? If you make a generality, if you make a statement saying that our life is less rich, our life is less nourishing and less rewarding than it used to be, obviously, you have to have evidence. I know sometimes, what's that old expression of people in research? He really gave he made a speech without fear and without research. I think that's a good old thing. And what Putnam has done is do his research. You've heard many a speech, without research. Okay, he's done research, all right. Just one that we all know. And it fits in with the idea of cooperation, of goodwill, and of confidence, really, in the future. Why, the first one would be, why this enormous decline in the turnout for our national elections every 4 years? That's one that grabs our attention. There are 25% fewer people who are voting in national elections than in the 1960s. 25% fewer people that are doing this. The most simple, the most basic task, all of American citizenship. The same trend is true for state and local elections also, as is true here. Something, in terms of our confidence in what we could do and our decision to get into this national politics things has disappeared. Okay. And it also has to be said, they say, ha-ha, I bet this is an international trend. No, it's not. In Europe, the voting percentage is up. It's over 90%. Can you imagine what would happen in this country if we'd have something like Europe? Not over 90% of the people turn out for national elections in England or Canada or Germany, France, wherever it is like that. They have an interesting thing there, which might make a difference here. There are some suggestions that have been made. One is voting on Sunday. Voting on Sunday, more people are free to vote on Sunday. Or another one is to take 2 weeks to vote. You don't have to vote on just one day. And then you at your precinct, you could have it. I'm sure most of you remember it. If you've signed your name and everything else, that takes care of you. It isn't the old Chicago system. What is it? Vote early, vote often. Or come early, vote often, right. But find some old relatives that are out in the graveyard that they haven't taken off the, you know, the voting roster yet. But, all right. Anyway, a clear trend there, and it's something that's, you know, happening in America, not in other places, you know, comparable to us. Okay. The same holds true, he argues, the same pattern holds true for attending a public meeting on town or, you know, local or school affairs. The decline there is significant. Unless it touches a person directly, now there's usually some outraged, you know, voters who are, it's funny, I was at Stehekin today, make some phone calls, and in a way I was delighted because it indicated something that, with the contrary to what I'm saying here, you got off the boat at Stehekin and there was a big sign, no condos in Stehekin. If you know that, it's a resort area and they didn't want these big super fancy condos there. And there were two people there and they had sort of scribbled it out and they didn't have any fancy printing or a lot of other things, and as soon as the boat left, they left also. But at least they were trying to do something, and they're yeah, right over here.
Go back to your point about the low voter turnout.
Right.
We hear a lot these days about a thing called virtual reality.
Right.
Whatever that is.
Something to do with the cyberspace.
I guess it has something to do with the perception is the reality. I suspect if you were to take a poll before an election, you would find that 90% of those of voting age would have a fairly distinct view on who should win, who they would vote for, who the good guys were, who the bad guys were. It's so ingrained in this perceived reality. They voted. They voted in their mind. The mechanical act of going to the polls is of no moment, because in their view, Clinton's a good guy or Dole's a good guy. And that's it. It's over. You know, why go any further trouble? And a lot of people spend their lives that way.
Yeah.
Could be. Perceiving reality and not living it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the American thrust these days.
You know, we're different world, sure, over here.
Well, when I grew up, we went to a one-room school.
Right.
And when you had a meeting, everybody in the community came.
Right.
And you were interested in everything that the kids were doing and everything. When my children started school, I tried to be interested in the things, but it was like, well, you don't, we're handling it, you don't need to be here. You know? So, you know, and they didn't involve the kids in anything. And they had a parent-teachers association. You had to pay to belong to it. Yeah, I went there, and I tried to understand what they were trying to do. And they said, well, you don't need to be here. And I said, well, don't the kids come to this? No, the kids don't come. Well, we had a parent-teachers association meeting when I was growing up. The kids went. They put on a program. The parents were there, and it was a community thing, and everybody had a good time.
Anybody else have comments on that or their experiences with PTA? I think well, where there's, yeah, the
back. There is another comment, too, yeah. And don't beat me up. The busing issue, crosstown busing of kids, and the parent association with the local school, association with the local school, I don't know, for good or bad, that. I know that people that teach in Seattle, I never did teach in Seattle itself, but when they started doing that, they did not have parent help.
Okay, thank you. I'm trying to think of the term they use for cross-town busing, where you know, if they take students from one area and bus them in another for achievement.
Well, Seattle's pulled back from that.
Okay, Eric.
A little different light, but I think that we have moved from a we society to an I society.
That's what I mean. Okay.
And it comes out to the fact, I don't care what happens to you as long as I get what I want.
Yeah.
And if you're down, I'll give you a kick so you sure don't get up because you might interfere with me.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of significant that the center word of the word sin is I, because I make myself my own God.
Yeah,
and what I do is right, and you better believe it.
Yeah, that started in they called the 1970s the me decade, with all the emphasis on self-growth and personal development and all the rest of the things at the expense of some other things. Okay, let me go ahead with this, and this is kind of comments obviously I think are very helpful. And out of this has come, especially in politics and what you were saying here, out of this have come some startling statistics that the number of people who say that they no longer trust the government in Washington, and this was in 1992, not 1996 or not 1997, I think, the number of people who say they no longer trust the government in Washington has risen from 30% to 75%. That just, you know, a huge kind of statistic here, from 30% to 75%. Okay. And there are all kinds of factors on this, but I want to go through some of the other statistics on this. Now, what about you know, other associations, other you know, areas where we have social capital? Some of this decline also shows up in the churches. Starting in the 1960s, in many churches, not all to be sure, but in many churches, there was a significant drop in enrollment and in attendance and in membership. And over 10% across the boards of American Protestant churches in the 1960s, you know, started to show up. All right, and this hasn't picked up over the subsequent decades. Now, that's important for this reason. There are the churches are at about the same level of membership in 1995, 96 as they were in 1960. And the significant thing here is that our total population in the country has gone up. And you'd think that if there are more people to join the churches, that would show up. But the actual numbers, 1995, are the same, about the same as in 1990. So there are all kinds of reasons for this. But obviously, people are finding ways of meeting certain kinds of needs and not going through the whole business here with church. Okay, altogether between Putnam says between 1960 and 1995, participation declined about 1/6. In American church life. So that's about 16-17%. Is a huge now, you know, as I say here, as I was talking to a couple of you beforehand, that's like preaching to the choir when I'm using statistics like this at home, but nevertheless I think it makes the point. Okay. And then I would say the thing about the Sunday night prayer meeting. Doesn't anybody else remember going to Sunday night prayer meeting? Anybody else? No. We went, and what I think killed it more than anything else was television. I'm going to say more about television later. And what they found in England, and it carried over here, was that Sunday night they found, to me it's still one of the best series that's ever been on television, Upstairs, Downstairs. You remember this one in the 1970s, an absolutely wonderful series. And it was on Sunday night, PBS knew the night, even today, Sunday night is the most watched, you know, there are more viewers on Sunday night than any other night. That's where you get 60 Minutes and Touched by an Angel and the other shows on those nights. But Upstairs, Downstairs, I think, did probably more than anything else because they found in England, it was that series, and what was the other one? Who was this woman who was a dog trainer? What was her name? And she was enormously popular, and in England she had a series.
Barbara Woodhouse?
Who is it?
Barbara Woodhouse?
That's the one, yeah. My wife has, I think, her complete collected works. They got so popular that they couldn't schedule anything on Sunday night, you know, in Britain because their thing was so popular. It does have an influence. Okay. Another thing besides churches here would be labor unions. We all, you know, one reason people got so excited about the Teamsters versus UPS was that they thought maybe this was a sign that labor unions were coming back into strength again. But clearly the trend up until, we don't know, it's just obviously much too early to tell that, but clearly the trend was in the other direction because some people, if you're not in the unions, people don't realize that much union strength has been in the socializing that goes with it. It isn't just in, you know, wage and, you know, bargaining for wages or better working conditions or anything else. A lot of people, like my son-in-law works in a steel mill there near Gary, and they have a huge recreational facility there with all the best facilities, swimming and, you know, everything else, basketball, and everything else like that. And this is his social life, as well as, I mean, his union is a social life, as well as having his union being the bargaining agent, obviously, with it happens to be Midwest Federal, not Midwest Federal, but Midwest Steel, on this sort of thing. But what's happened here in the last 30 years, that looking here at non-agricultural workforce in this country, the unions have dropped from 32.5% to 15.8%. That's a drop of over 17% in membership, you know, over this period of time. That's a huge statistic because for a while, remember the old labor song, "Solidarity Forever." The union will make us strong, just like a tree plant. Remember when we were young radicals, and some of you know, I went to University of Wisconsin for my graduate work, and I think they we prided ourselves, we're going to organize and we're going to go down to Gish Holt machine, if you know Madison, and unionize the workers and save them. And they weren't amused at all with us young intellectuals coming down there and trying to, you know, to save them. But anyway, the unions were seen as sort of the wave of the future. It's simply no longer the case now.
There is one dramatic exception to that, of course, that's the public sector unions.
I'm sorry?
The public sector unions have grown like a weed. Yeah,
right.
They just strangle every
you mean ARP and
every level of government.
ARP and others?
You don't have a choice.
You mean the workers? You mean for federal
organized
government?
Organized labor in the public sector.
Yeah, right.
If you're a teacher, you don't have a choice.
Public sector is growing.
Is it a closed, what we would call a closed shop?
Exactly.
A closed shop, meaning you can't get the job unless you join the union?
You pay the dues anyway, yeah. Whether you belong or not. You pay the dues, state, county, and clerk. So it's really, it got you.
School clerk.
Okay.
In the national, you don't have a choice.
Okay. Oh, anyway. The same statistics hold true here, for instance, for League of Women Voters, for Red Cross, other agencies like this, Lions, Masons, the service ones. One that's kind of nice to see is that the membership in the Veterans Associations is going down, which means we don't have to, you know, we're not fighting wars anymore, so we're not going to have any people join. I mean, there'll always be, I suppose, American Legion that'll be available, but what's going to happen to veterans of foreign wars? We don't have any foreign wars anymore. Yeah.
I was in Rotary Club quite a while, and Rotary was doing okay, but they were barely staying even, but it wasn't because of various clubs holding their own or getting more members, because they were starting new clubs around the world,
mm-hmm.
especially when the Iron Curtain was down. Otherwise, they were dropping as well.
They also started admitting women.
Oh, yeah, that's a great behavior.
How do you feel about that?
I'm sorry you asked, because I was president of our local club the year that happened, and a significant person in our local paper asked me the same question, and I gave an answer that got misquoted, and I've been in trouble ever since.
I was president too, and I kept my mouth shut. But we brought women in to our club, and it really didn't make a difference. They didn't really come in great numbers.
Did they feel welcome?
We made the three rednecks that didn't want them quit. So the rest of the guys, welcomed them, and they didn't overrun the club. We had a hard time getting enough women, even though few did come in.
Ours are very welcome, very active, and the two rednecks died.
Trying to think of the name of the one of the groups that spent $12 million in legal fees to keep them out, and you could have just as well taken that $12 million and, you know, tossed it right out the window for all the good it did them on these things. That's the old Reinhold Niebuhr prayer, the serenity prayer: God give us the courage to dare do the things that have to be done, patience to accept the things that can't be changed, and the wisdom to know the difference. And this was a tide that was there. Okay. What about the thing, I use the expression here of solo bowling. What kind of evidence do we have here? Now, this is a fairly long quote, but this is sort of what made Putnam start thinking about these things. He said, the most whimsical yet discomforting bit of evidence in social disengagement in contemporary America that I have discovered is this. Most Americans are bowling today more than ever before. But bowling in organized leagues has plummeted in the last decade or so. Between 1980 and 1993, the total number of bowlers in America increased by 10%. That sounds good. Increased by 10%, Brunswick stocks go up, okay. While league bowling decreased by 40%. This is individual bowling, total bowling went up 10%, league bowling went down by 40%. This be thought a wholly trivial example, I should note that nearly 80 million Americans went bowling at least once during 1993. Nearly a third more than voted in the 1994 congressional elections, which gives you some indication here. And roughly the same number that claimed to attend church regularly. Okay. Even after the 1980s plunge in league bowling, nearly 3% of American adults regularly bowl in leagues. Okay. The rise in solo bowling threatens the livelihood of bowling lane proprietors. because those who bowl as members of leagues consume three times as much beer and pizza as solo bowlers. And the money in bowling is in the beer and the pizza, not in the balls and shoes. The broader social significance, however, lies in the social interaction and even occasionally civic conversations over the beer and pizza that solo bowlers forego. I know myself, my barber looks forward, I think he's been bowling, you know, in the Northfield Leagues for 30 years, and I think they have 30 trophies, you know, in his barbershop, because that Tuesday night is his night, and prides himself on adding a new one, and he's remodeled the shop a couple of times, because he's got, you know, he's got a team going, and they talk about this, and sometimes they come in and share, and, you know, and enjoy things. Okay. They social interaction and even civic conversations over beer and pizza that solo bowlers forego. Whether or not bowling beats balloting in the eyes of most Americans, bowling teams illustrate yet another vanishing form of social capital. I think that's you know, a pretty good point. Yeah, any? Yes.
Well, we bowled in a league for a long time, but you know, I never became a very good bowler, and so I always had to buy in the beer frame, and I don't drink beer. So I decided, well, why should I bowl in a league when I don't drink beer? Because I always end up buying, so then I thought I'd go solo.
What can I say? I don't want to sound anything other. Take bowling lessons.
I was voted the most improved bowler, but I still ended up in the beer frame having to buy it. I just think it was...
Something in life you just can't change. Yeah.
The wisdom to know the difference.
The wisdom to know the difference.
My son took up bowling in the bowling league, and I asked him about it the other day, and I said, are you going to go in the bowling league? Because we then get to babysit our granddaughter when he's bowling, see? And he said, no, and I said, why? And I'll paraphrase what he said, that his economic capital did not equal his social capital. In other words, it cost too much.
That's one problem. Obviously, that's, you know, certainly with sports and everything else, I can understand that. But I don't know where to go with that one. If it depends on what you decide you want to do, and if you want to do bowling, then you might have to, you know, cut back on some expenditure somewhere else, or it could be golf, or, you know, with me, with bicycling. And things like that, you have to sort of say, you can't do everything all the time, right?
But we also have available everything.
Yes, we do.
Which we didn't used to do.
Yeah. Right. That's makes you know, a lot of very, sometimes very difficult choices.
Aren't there a lot more teams in schools than there used to be?
Teams. Well, yeah, I know what you're saying.
Team sports.
Well, there's some that have caught on, and in a sense, there's this one thing he hasn't thought about here. Maybe it's just me in the last couple of years, but one group that's contrary to what he's talking about here are those we call soccer moms. Because soccer has caught on, you know, enormously in the high schools. And personally, myself, I'm very happy about it, because for one thing, it's the least expensive, you know, thing, and we don't have to raise taxes. Obviously, to pay for soccer uniforms, all you need is a ball and a net. And that, and if, you know, like Minnesota, we have hockey. And what our high school did here, and this is a good point because it gets parents involved and PTA and sports and all these things. What the parents said, and what the school board said, was, yes, we will have hockey, but the parents have to pay for the equipment. Because what is it, $300 or something per boy or girl for hockey? That's very, very expensive. There's nothing except short pants and a ball for soccer. Of course, you know, one is in the winter and one is the summer.
Medical insurance.
Yeah. But
medical,
I think,
insurance.
I'm sorry?
There's medical insurance.
Medical insurance, yeah. But what's happened is that soccer moms, in fact, that term has even made the latest dictionaries. You know what I mean? The soccer moms, the ones who will drive anywhere, go anywhere, change any schedule to get their kids out, you know, for soccer.
We have a senator who got elected on that thing.
You know, in Washington.
Patty Murray in Washington.
In Washington, okay. I believe you. I guess, on soccer mom themes?
Yep. That's what she campaigned as, a soccer mom.
There's a new block. There isn't just labor block. Now we've got to deal with the soccer moms block. And they're organized. Are they Republican or Democrat, or it doesn't matter? Or does it cut across party lines? Better have an investigation right away, I think. It sounds pretty suspicious. You know,
maybe there's a shift there, too. Like in the Northwest or the Seattle area, soccer starts late August, and it runs into December, and it's from 6 years old or 5 years old all the way up through high school. And the fields are, you know, you have your times, and you've got to be there. Everything is full. And same with the softball teams with guys, so for the softball league is big in the area. Those kind of teams seem to be going, and maybe is it a shift from indoors to outdoors? I don't know if this fellow has looked at all those things.
I hadn't thought of this one. This is a good point you make. My own feeling would be with high school kids and junior high kids too, is whatever happened to spontaneity and to pickup games and things like that, where everything wasn't given to them. And they didn't have sort of adult reward systems with trophies and all the rest of these things, because sometimes these things can get, you know, totally out of hand. They would have you ever seen the picture sometimes of, they had it in the Minneapolis paper once, of a mother who had her son who was a wrestler. They didn't show the pictures, you know, of the boy wrestling, but they showed the picture of the mother in the stands wrestling. She was into it. I mean, she was, you know, ooh, where are you? And like this. And obviously what, you know, it occurred to her, and I can, you know, maybe this is true for your experience too, the kids got into it because they did it to please their parents or keep their parents quiet rather than, you know, enjoying it for themselves. And I think something is lost at that particular point, because I've got a whole long thing we could do in organized sports, but with television and you call it virtual reality and everything else, all the models now are professional athletes. And then in a way that's too bad. We have the example in Minnesota, the incredible one, where this 21-year-old boy was, you know, was offered $17 million a year to play what I call, you know, grown men in short pants and sneakers putting a rubber ball through an iron hoop. And he was offered $17 million a year, guaranteed. And it was turned it down. You know, so there's some, I don't want to get off on sports on this, except that it goes both ways, I think, with that. And I would say, too, with kids, well, that comes later on the television. I've got something to say about that, but sure.
I was going to comment that, you know, from about the mid-30s on, mid to late 30s, we started as a nation to have, we were able to begin to have a perspective of a little more than just survival, getting enough food on the table, enough clothes, enough housing.
Right.
So we already really had about 60 years of this post-grub in the muck and mire history. Other than the very wealthy and the leadership. You know, the vast majority of people have had about 60 years to do it. We've had about two 30-year cycles so far. Mm-hmm. We had that first cycle of Sunday night prayer meeting and pickup games and good old boy stuff. And then about mid-60s, you know, we started to move into all liberalism elements and, of course, Vietnam. And it's been another mix since then. We may simply be on the verge of another 30-year chunk of something that Hollywood or Walt Disney Productions will dream up for us to, you know, keep us busy for the next 30 years. And it may not have any real lasting substance.
Yeah.
Any of it. Just another twink of the eye, you know, in a country that's already 300 plus years old. We're only looking at 10% chunks when we talk about what's happened since the mid-60s, for example. 10% of our history. And 10% of that prior period. So it's really hard to say that there's anything really long-term associated with this, as opposed to a disenchantment and a whole new thrust coming.
Well, it always depends. In history analysis like this, it always depends on, you know, how long you make your time frame. I always say it always depends on where you slice the bologna, if you want to put it in, you know, that particular term. Because in a short term, there's no question Putnam is onto something here. On this, in the long term, you know, it depends on how far back you go. Obviously, there are some things over a long period of time which haven't changed very much. But in a short period of time, I think there have been some rather things. It all depends on how wide or long you want to make your time frame. Okay. So as long as I've done the research, I'll keep, you know, going with this. But this point, all right, now. What about, some counter trends? One trend has been in this country very interesting. A distinguished sociologist at Princeton named Robert Wethnow has done a study of what he calls small groups in America. The small groups, usually meeting once a week or twice a week, not a week or twice a month or once a month, come together, 10, 12, 15 people, that'd be the most, who come together and share deep personal problems and issues and are there for social support and help for one another. And Wessnow argues, and he's got good statistics on this, that up to 40% of all Americans belong to at least one small group. Maybe some of you do these. Sometimes they're called koinonia groups. Just for fun, you know what I'm talking about? Groups where you come, and what I found interesting is that usually they find they work best when the minister isn't there. And the ministers say that's fine. They don't want to get involved because they figure when the minister comes in, the minister has an agenda. And that so everybody sits back and sort of lets the minister do the thing, and that's the end of it, any end to spontaneity or care for this. But a lot of other people, I'm not talking just about AA or 12-step or, you know, a lot of things like this, and some of them come and go, but basically you'd say, well, isn't this sort of a counter trend? Well, Wessnow says this: small groups may not be fostering community as effectively as many of their proponents would like. Some small groups merely provide occasions for individuals to focus on themselves in the presence of others. The social contract binding members together asserts that only the weakest of obligations. Okay, come if you have time, talk if you feel like it, you know, whatever, you know, that wonderful term, whatever, that's, you know, no problem, whatever. Never criticize, leave quietly if you become dissatisfied. Garrison Keillor has a wonderful one on this. He was going, and I think it was based on reality, not just on something he made up. He went to one of these groups, and they went in the basement, and everybody was singing Kumbaya. That's the way you started. And everybody saw each other, and they hugged, and they held hands, and they did these things. And then they sang Kumbaya some more, and then they told a few stories and hugged some more, and then they had one last round of Kumbaya, and they all went home thinking, we'd had a wonderful time. Maybe Jacob's Ladder was in there, too, that was about, you know, the extent of it. We can imagine that these small groups really substitute for families, neighborhoods, and broader community attachments that may demand lifelong commitments, when in fact they do not, is basically one thing he's saying here. Okay, they've got other examples on this, but he has sort of four explanations of why this is happening in light of what you're talking about with a long time frame on this, and I want to get into these. He argues there are four things that have happened basically since the 1960s that have helped bring on this decline in social capital. First of all, he said women in the workforce. Up to 60%, I think it is now, of all adult women are wage earners. I think the figure now is about 60% of all those who are wage earners, which means obviously they have less time for League of Women Voters, less time for AAUW, that's the American Association of University Women, PTA, Red Cross, things like that, where their, you know, traditional constituency had always been. But he said that in spite of this, the statistics that he has shows that, yes, with more women in the workforce, it still hasn't changed the workload at home. Women still are doing about the same amount of housework, even though they may be full-time working, were wage earners than had been the case before. And that funny story I told you today when we were going on how this has changed a lot of things. It works the other way too with men, where this has happened to be with retirement. I was sitting at the Walmart in Scottsdale, and talking with a fellow who, you know, when you go into these stores, and there's a nice fellow out there to greet you and gives you the cart, and off you go, and he tells you where you can find batteries or motor oil, rubber bands, or whatever it is, and everything else. And we got talking for a while. I was waiting for something, I can't remember. And I asked him, you know, why did you, you know, we got talking about how nice it is to retire and how much fun it was and everything. And I said, well, if you're here, then why are you, you know, since you're here, you know, why aren't you retired? Why did you take up the job doing this? And he said, you know, when I first got retired and moved down here to Arizona, he said, we thought it was pretty nice, but then I was home all the time, and pretty soon me and the missus, we just didn't get along anymore. So he had to take the job to get out, you know, to get out of the house. And he didn't take on any of her work. That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. That was the point. He didn't do laundry or any of the other things like this. So one reason for a lack of decline in social capital clearly would be that. I think that's very important one. A second one would be in this country, geographical mobility. People are moving, you know, enormous number of times. It's very difficult to put in roots when you're transferred if you're working for, you know, American Express or Prudential or whatever it might be, or or Bill Gates or something, it's very difficult to establish a sort of a sense of community and go back. This is very true also with the churches. I give a lecture, I call Whatever Happened to the Old Time Religion, and one of the major forces that had broke up the old time religion and the old ethnic churches was simply mobility. People move all the time. You can't hold on to the old Italian Catholic Church or the old Swedish Lutheran Church the way you did before, because it changes all the time. If you have the statistics, maybe I know, I have some pastors in here, if you'd have the statistics on how fast the turnover is in membership in your church, even in the small towns, it's really quite remarkable. So social capital is not increased by the huge turnovers that you have in institutions like that. And one, I know I'm going to preach to the choir here, but one that Putnam doesn't have, but I think is making an enormous difference, and that's gambling. And the last, if you were to pick up one major theme that's changed American life in the last 4 or 5 years, if we're grabbing the time frame thing, it would be the casinos. I think more than any of the others, it's a key thing. The enormous amount of money that goes into this, and if there ever was a one-to-one, entertainment, it's gambling. I mean, there's no community, there's no anything else like that. You get in the bus. They pick you up at Shea and Pima at 5:30, and off you go to the Mindawakaton or whatever it is, casino out there, and all the I'm preaching to the choir, so anyway. people say, well, why do you feel so strongly about this? I remember what happened to me was the first time I went, when I was single again, and I was in Northfield, and there isn't a whole lot to do in Northfield on Saturday afternoons in the summer. So I went up to the racetrack at Shakopee. And I was sitting, and I didn't bet on the first race. And another fellow near me came in and did bet, and came back after the first race, and he had his kids there and everything else. And he pulled out a brand new $100 bill, and he snapped it. And you've ever heard how nice a $100 bill sounds, when you snap it like this, and the kids, gee, Dad, he got $100. Oh, this thing. By the time I was out of there, I was very careful, and I followed all the tout sheets and everything else. I lost $36, and I remember I had to go after the sixth race. I had to go to the men's room, and thank goodness it was like I was getting divine providence or guidance here. The men's room was near, the exit, and I walked to the men's room, and I could see the exit, and I just kept right on going. I haven't been back. Now I often wonder what I could have done with that $36. But anyway, there is some hope on the gambling thing. There was a piece in 60 Minutes this spring. There's a Methodist minister. He goes around full time and talking to various voter groups. I don't know if you saw this. I'm sure it was 60 Minutes with more of a safer on this. But clearly, it's taking away not enormous amounts of money, but it's taking away because there's just no way in which that goes on. Okay, the last one is the one that's the most obvious in the causes here, but the one which, is where the statistics are the clearest, and that's television. If you're looking for what has broken up community and turned us into individuals, solo bowlers, and all the rest of these things over the long period of time, it's television. Okay. In 1950, less than 10% of the American public owned television sets. Remember Captain Munts? Wasn't that the name of a television set? Wasn't some terrible...
Munts TV,
that's what it was, yeah, right. And we had in Minneapolis, we had Mel Jass for a TV announcer, good Lord. Anyway, less than 10% owned televisions. By 1960, 95% of Americans owned television sets, just to give you some indication here. It's the fastest spread of a technological technological innovation that's ever been recorded. The viewing hours per capita has grown from 17% up to over 60%. On this thing. As far as we can tell, people watch on the average 4 hours, maybe some just, statistics say 3.5 hours, but 4 hours of their free time. And now multiple sets have proliferated to where, you have a set like radios, where you have a set in the rooms, and if you don't like that show, then I'll go and watch, my show.
What you just said was very significant. 4 hours of their free time, which implied a huge vacuum sitting looking out the window or sucking your thumb or something, that said, I've got nothing to do for the next 4 hours. I'm glad I've got TV to fill this enormous hole in my life. That's the real point to be pursued. How they could have 4 hours of, quote, free time in the first place.
By free time, I mean they're not at work and they're not at the dinner table. That's what I mean. That's free time.
I'm not faulting you. I'm faulting the use of that term.
No.
I think it's
the term.
To say that
discretionary.
They didn't have to pursue education. Okay. They didn't have to pursue crafts. They didn't have to pursue volunteer work, community.
We'll change the word and we'll use
repairs.
We'll use discretionary. How about you? I'll finish. We'll use discretionary time instead of free time. Is that all right? Discretionary, because you have some choice over that, right? Yeah, like, because you don't have to watch television, and you don't have to go visit with your neighbors either, but
anything approaching a work ethic would deny calling that free time is all I'm trying to say.
Okay, well, we call it discretionary. That's when you have a matter of time element on this, but what I'm trying what he's trying to say here is that clearly the tube has won. And it's like gambling, and we can make all the statements we want about gambling and all the rest, but gambling is not going to go away. That's the first thing. When we get all the, we find this, it's like Prohibition in the 20s. Prohibition failed. It's a noble, you know, social experiment, but it failed. Gambling is not going to go away. The same thing is true with television. So the thing to do then, obviously, is to see, you know, what really can be done. And he's got the statistics here, and he said, to show you the differences here on social capital, he compared heavy newspaper readers to heavy TV watchers. Okay, heavy newspaper readers to heavy TV watchers. Heavy newspaper readers are heavy joiners of these associations, while heavy viewers of television are likely to be the loners. People who use newspapers for their primary source of information belong to 76 more civic organizations than those who use television, as an example for this. This holds true in other categories also. Those who read newspapers show much more trust of others and in the government and vote much more often than those who rely only on television. Yeah.
Well, just thinking about television, and we're all kind of scared of it, I think you see so many, I've seen some science fiction movies in the future, way, way in the future, like Running Man or something, where they show game shows that are to entertain people as it classifies them. You know, when you say, I just want to stupefy the masses, and what you do is you give them this entertainment, and they put these in the science fiction show. That I think there's a lot of truth in what they put in science fiction. What we're scared of, the society where television is given to us as a drug, as something to keep society under its thumb. Yeah.
Well, that assumes that there's some sort of big mastermind up there somewhere that's responsible
that's
for all this. Big Brother, you know, like 1984, Orwell's 1984. I don't think
Michael
that's
Eisner.
The case. I'm sorry?
His name is Michael Eisner, he said.
I'm missing that one.
Walt Disney.
He's the CEO of Disney.
Okay. Well, there was always, you know, what the TV preachers found, there was always the danger that, you know, people will find the off button. And that has made a difference. But clearly what's happened in television, you know, is a decline in what you call any kind of standards or norms at all, and especially the talk show things and the things in the afternoon ones. I should have brought it along. Garrison Keillor has a book of short stories that he wrote called The Book of Guys, and one of the stories is about Chuck, who has his own TV talk show in the afternoon, and he's out trying to do everybody else. You know, with vulgar and you know, court sort of thing. So what I'm trying to suggest that in many areas, like with television, if there was some sort of hope that television, since it's here to stay, might be something that might improve some of this thing we're talking about with social capital here, it's going, you know, going in the other direction. I don't really see much reason for, that's one reason, for instance, I've gone to radio myself. I watch the news and maybe an old movie, and of course there are always the Vikings. I won't, I'll make my exception for the Vikings, but hope springs eternal, you know, with them. I've given up on the times, but yeah.
Yeah, there was a gentleman who mentioned that we seem to go in 30-year cycles, and I wonder if television isn't also following that trend, because television originally, when I was very small, we only had about four stations, and everyone watched those four stations. Mm-hmm. And they're really, I know that the general trend is to think of television always as being evil, but in fact, for me personally, growing up, television was a common ground that I can still reminisce with people that are my age about shows that we grew up with. I mean, we can all sing the Brady Bunch song, and we can all, and those are, even though we grew up far apart, those are shared experiences for us. And
yeah.
So for us, that's a very positive thing. But what they've been coming out with more recently is that people are starting to spend more time in front of their computers. Mm-hmm. And in fact, what they've found is that computer time is directly taken from television time. Mm-hmm. So the time that you spend in front of your computer now is what used to be what you spent in front of your television.
For goodness sake.
And television is no longer the binding force that it used to be because of the generation of cable now. Cable television gives you so many choices that it's no longer a common experience among a generation. So television, I think, will become not only less binding, but also less important in the future.
What's that old song? Wouldn't that be lovely?
Internet chat rooms are very...
Internet chat. Oh yeah. I know. I got hooked, I got over it. I mean, when I got mine, it's the first thing in the morning and the last thing at night. And I have full access to, you know, lots of things. I have this NLF one, but then I also have, since we're down in Scottsdale, I have full access to the Arizona State University one. So I have everything else like that. And finally, after about a year or so, it just sort of died out. It's just like they're showing that on television, or they're saying that, you know, on the movies or something else. Maybe I'm wrong, but then I guess there are people who get addicted with this. Then other people will say, this is a good point, other people will say, well, maybe there is a social bond because you're writing or you're chatting with somebody else.
That is a small group.
In a small group,
there's
yeah.
Two people,
right. How about some retirement people here? I notice, I haven't gone to any, maybe I should down at Scottsdale Phoenix, they'll have weekly meetings of people just getting started on the computers. And so that, you know, and these are free and they're not there to sell, you know, things like that. Have any of you had any experiences with those? I haven't. I'm just curious. That might be a way of getting people, you know, to
yeah, I go to 2 a month.
2 a month. Okay. Do you talk a lot?
Yeah.
Okay. About what?
Computers.
Computers.
And then we end up talking about everything else too.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And then somebody comes in and has a problem, and then we get about involved with equipment and then programs. And
I think that's fair. Where is this?
Wichita.
Wichita. I think. That's remarkable. How did you find out about it?
Yeah.
How did you learn about it?
Apple Forever.
Apple Forever?
Yeah. For Mac.
Oh, they let you know? I mean, did they?
So I belong to each one. An Apple Club for my antiquated 2C, 2GS, and then a Mac Club for my Mac.
Now that, you know, what you're saying here is it might be, you know, that if somebody else has that same kind of general situation, they might start talking with him. And I found, for instance, when I do my thing about it, it took me 6 weeks to learn how to do my, you know, my word processing. And I would rather have gone through boot camp, which I did. I'd rather go through basic training, you know, with my sergeant giving me the business all the time than learning how to manage that thing. And I was ready to throw it out. I was ready to trade it. I was ready to kick it. I was ready to do anything with it. And that little thing just kept going all the time. And, you know, nothing ever happened and everything. And then once after 6 weeks, I hit print screen. You know, and one thing, you can't use the directions are not let. They're not intelligent. No way. They just do not give you any information. And finally, the fellow who sold me the thing said, "Erling, call me anytime." I took him seriously. After about the 15th call, he said, "Erling, don't call me anymore." And you know, because you'd get a lot, get lost, and everything else. But it was going back and forth, and then I'd have to. I wrote my own. I don't know. Did any of you have this experience? I wrote my own instructions. I'd try something. I'd write it down what I did in my language. And then I would hit it, and then it almost, then it really got mad. Then they said, "Bad command." I'm used to saying, I mean, getting wrong all the time. I mean, if it's a wrong command, okay, but they're making a moral judgment just because I hit the wrong button. I mean, it said bad command. Maybe that's why it was WordStar. Maybe that's why WordStar went out. But anyway, back and forth and on. And but finally, one day I hit print screen and all the clatter and everything else. I cried. It worked, you know. It really worked. And so I can share that with other people. That's what I'm trying to suggest with this. And maybe, you know.
When I'm going back to the radio and music.
Yeah.
When I'm on the TV, on the computer, because I can't mess around with television, so I've got a particular radio station that has easy to listen to semi-classical music, or I've got my
music right on the computer, so I can turn it on and play music while I'm doing the computer.
Maybe there is hope here. Seriously, with some of these things, I know myself with sports, it works both ways. Once I'd been here and I took Amtrak back, and then I'll finish with a story. I took Amtrak back to St. Paul again, and I was with a friend, and I met somebody in the diner, and we, you know, there isn't a whole lot to do in Amtrak except talk and move back and forth and everything, and that's why I like it, you know, much better than an airplane or something. Well, anyway, we sat down and we started talking, and we both like baseball. And by the time we were done, we had told the old baseball stories for 4 hours. There's your Brady Bunch thing, but this was baseball, right? Mm-hmm. And my friend had never heard anything like this before. I told Harmon Killebrew stories and Tony Oliva stories and you know, and Rod Carew stories and all the great days of, you know, of the Twins in their heyday. And he told me stories, you know, about his team. And we got together, and you know, it really was something that sort of brought us together. Otherwise, you know, we would have lost out on a real opportunity. So there are ways, that's what I'm trying to say. And I think I like the idea about the computer. Yeah.
I'm just going to introduce a couple of statistics that seem to me very relevant to the set of stuff you've been talking about. For example, the bottom 20% of the population enjoys 5% of the gross domestic product. Conversely, the post-65-year-old group is only 8% of the population, controls one-third of the nation's wealth. You got such humongous disparities there, and outlooks, you know, are 35 million people, right? The strongest single force, presumably, in the country, if you read the paper. There's great imbalances in right. Where the power is, and from that, where the interests seem to be flowing.
And it doesn't seem to be getting any better.
I don't know.
It's not getting any better. Should we take a vote on what, or somebody want to stand up on what we should do?
Yeah.
I think it's important to raise the issues and to let us know sometimes that there are other people thinking the same thing that we do. And if any of the rest of you have any horror stories about your difficulty in learning, you know, your word processing, I'd be glad. I'd really. And my wife said she heard words from me that she didn't know that I knew. And it was, I thought I was back in the barracks again. As you know, sure.
Someone shot his computer.
Somebody shot I?
Yeah.
Sounds good. Okay, we'll talk some more. Okay, thank you.